Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast. My name is Steve Schaefer, and I'm the director of the Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project. We are pleased to have with us today Jonathan Wolfson and Tanner Jones from the Cicero Institute to explain some of their ideas in their paper, Restoring Legislative Authority, A Balanced Approach to Agency Deference. Please note that any opinions expressed are those of the experts. So before we begin, Jonathan and Tanner, what are your professional backgrounds and what is your current role at the Cicero Institute?
Well, first, Steve, thanks for having us. We really appreciate the opportunity to be here. I have the privilege of being the Chief Legal Officer and Policy Director at the Cicero Institute, and I've been here for about 3.5 years. Prior to that, I ran the Policy Office at the U.S. Department of Labor. And before that, I spent a decade in private law practice. So I've gotten kind of the experience of being in private practice, of seeing how regulatory sausage is made from the inside of the government, see how regulators deal with the folks on the outside who are in private practice, and then have now gotten to work on the policy front at Cicero.
I'm Tanner, graduated from Dartmouth in 2023, studied politics, philosophy, and economics with a minor in classical studies. Beyond that, during COVID, founded a company that works in local level political campaigns in 7 states, mayor, school board, city council. So that was my first kind of interaction with government policy and regulation, and then closing in on a year at the Cicero Institute.
That's fantastic. Thank you. So what was the impetus for writing this paper, Restoring Legislative Authority, A Balanced Approach to Agency Deference?
So when the Chevron deference decision came out in Loper-Bright, there was all sorts of conversation about what does this mean for administrative law? What does this mean for regulation? But one of the questions that wasn't really being delved into as deeply as we felt like it could be was, what does this mean for the states? And obviously, the Loper-Bright decision was a statutory interpretation decision, wasn't constitutional, doesn't apply, doesn't explicitly to the states. So if you have a state that's already adopted Chevron deference still lives on in that state. But when states now are thinking about this, and lawyers who are in the courts, but also lawyers practicing or lawyers in the legislature, what is this? What are the implications of this new framing that's going to be going on at the federal level? And we thought, hey, maybe there are certain times that deference is not a bad thing. While we are generally very supportive of the Loper decision, we think it's the right decision. We think that at the state level, there may be instances where the legislature is intending for the regulatory agency to come out and issue regulations. And we think that the courts should pay attention to what the legislature wants rather than just trying to take a all or nothing approach. And so we tried to come up with a balanced approach that allowed the legislature to dictate when the courts would step in with a heavy hand and when the courts would step in with a light hand.
And in your paper, you pose the question, who makes most of your state laws, the elected legislature or unelected bureaucrats? What is your answer to this question, and why does it matter who makes most state laws?
Yeah, I mean, I think this was a useful framing device as when I was talking to folks in my family or people not really deep into the weeds in administrative law about what deference means, what it meant for Chevron to be overruled. I think the administrative state is a black box to most people where, I mean, like the story we get from Schoolhouse Rock and in our civics class growing up is that you have access to your elected representatives. You tell them to make the law. But in reality, most of the fees and fines incurred by small businesses, the compliance burdens, what you're paying lawyers to deal with if you are trying to set up some kind of entrepreneurial endeavor, what you're really dealing with most of the time is the regulatory administrative state. So while, of course, there are statutes, many of which have a day-to-day impact on our lives, I think our answer on balance to this question would be that for most people, and particularly business owners, it's actually the unelected people in the administrative state that wield the force of law.
And I think, you know, one thing that's important for folks to think about is we have conversations about the federal regulatory burden all the time, right? When President Trump was in office, he put a massive crane on the south lawn of the White House where he showed how many pounds of regulatory burden they were lifting off of the American businesses. And so that was showing how burdens had been built up at the federal level and burdens in his mind were being taken down by being deregulatory in the Trump administration. But we don't have that same conversation on a regular basis at the state level. But there are millions and millions and millions of words of regulatory restrictions at the state level. There's the average state has about 140,000 regulatory restrictions, according to research that Mercatus Center does every year. So this is not one of those things where a typical business, as Tanner's talking about, is having to face, oh, there might be a couple additional compliance burdens that my state has imposed on me. You've got a massive federal burden. You know, there's estimates that say every year the compliance burdens impose about a $2 trillion cost at the federal level of regulations on our economy. And if that's paying attention to only the federal, how much greater is that burden at the state level? And it's a question that really people need to be thinking about and legislators need to be thinking about as they're putting laws on the books, because everything that happens to folks in their state is getting piled on top of the statutes and regulations that are coming down from the federal government.
And is that why I know, like, you know, typically when it comes to, you know, legal papers or legal analysis or in this case, you know, an accessible piece, the focus is on the federal agencies and the federal administrative state. You know, why is it that, you know, this paper specifically focuses on like state legislatures and state agencies?
Yeah, well, there's a few reasons we chose to focus on the states. And the first and foremost is at the CICERO Institute, we are really focused on state policy. What we do on a daily basis at the CICERO Institute is try to build innovative entrepreneurial solutions to public policy problems focused at the state level. And so as a result of that being our organization's focus, it made it easy for Tanner and I, when we were working on this paper, to say, hey, let's start thinking about this question from the state perspective. Secondly, because our organization is focused on the states, there's a lot of questions that we've received from state legislators, from folks in governor's offices. How does this Loper-Bright opinion affect us as the states? What ought we be doing? And so that really created an opportunity in our minds to say, what should we put out there as a policy, just like we would if we have someone come to us and say, hey, we're trying to figure out how to get more doctors in the field. And we can say, hey, there's this policy that CICERO has worked on allowing internationally licensed doctors to get licensed in the United States. Similarly, in the regulatory policy world, we think that there's some solutions. And the third is that, as you mentioned, there's a ton of discussion and conversation about what's going on at the federal level. There's a ton of structure in federal regulation. There's OIRA that is developing, as your listeners know, all the rules and frameworks for how the various agencies interact with the White House and get a regulation out the door. A lot of states don't have anywhere near that strict of a structure. They may have an Administrative Procedures Act. Most of them do, but those acts are sometimes followed and sometimes not, or they have ways that they can get around them. And so we thought that having the courts in the states and the legislature and the governor's office really think about what is this interaction going to look like for them going forward was a really important group to focus on as we were developing kind of this concept, which we think could work at the federal level, but we really think would be optimal at the state level.
And in the title of this paper itself, you use the phrase agency deference. So what is, you know, agency deference? I know that in the paper you reference the 1984 U.S. Supreme Court decision Chevron versus National Resource Defense Council. But for those unfamiliar, you know, what is agency deference?
Yeah, great question, Steve. And that's probably a really important framing as we get into the rest of this conversation. You know, in 1984, when the Supreme Court writes the National Resources Defense Council Chevron decision that we've all kind of grown up, any of us who went to law school, learned about it in our admin law classes, the reality is what it means is that if there is ambiguity in what a statute means, which almost every statute is going to have some ambiguity, that the courts were going to treat a reasonable interpretation of that statute by the agency as if it were the best interpretation and not going to try to exchange the court's interpretation of the statute for the agency's. And so what does that mean? Well, that means if you have a statute that says we're going to ban the sale of dangerous toys to children, that they're going to say to the Consumer Product Safety Commission, we're going to let you decide what the word dangerous means. Does that mean too much lead paint on toys that kids can put in in their mouths. We're going to let you, the agency, decide what is the kid definition, because dangerous toys being sold to kids could mean a lot of different things. Does my 12-year-old getting that toy matter? Well, lead paint on a toy that a 12-year-old has, probably not as big a deal as lead paint on a toy that my 1-year-old nephew is going to play with, right? Those sorts of things. And so the thought was, these agencies have some information. We're going to let them make those decisions instead of the courts. That was a great concept. And I think that there were a lot of folks, Justice Scalia himself was a huge proponent of that opinion. But over time, people have started to realize that maybe this was not the way they wanted the world to work. And unfortunately, as the laws have become significantly greater, bigger and bigger burdens of statutes on the society, the agencies have had more and more opportunities to take those statutes and apply them to people in ways that, in many cases, the legislatures would have never expected. And so we've seen those sorts of situations where courts are being approached with cases where a statute from the 1970s is being used to say you can't have a coal-fired power plant in the 2020s. And there's a great question there of, did the legislature in the 1970s ever assume that their law could be used to ban the use of coal fire in generating electricity? And I think that universally, from the furthest to the right to the furthest to the left member of the House and Senate in the 1970s when they passed the Clean Air Act, no one would have expected that it was going to be used to ban coal-fired power plants. And so that sort of deference to the agencies has been utilized by the agencies to push the envelope. And both parties do it. This is not a one side of the aisle issue. The reality is that both parties will use the pen and the phone, as President Obama said, and will attempt to use the regulatory state to exert their will. Sometimes that is, as President Trump did, to try to reduce the number of regulatory burdens and say, we're going to take these down. We're going to maybe do something that is less burdensome on the society. But maybe the legislature actually wanted there to be a big burden on society as part of that law. And so both parties use this. And ultimately, the real thing, and if you talk to folks who are political appointees, from either side of the aisle who work in these agencies, often the reality is that there's activity going on inside those agencies that the senior leadership in those agencies don't know about. And that's kind of what's brought this to the fore, where a lot of folks start questioning, do you want these regulatory agencies to make these kinds of hugely impactful decisions of what the law is, when courts tend to be pretty good at reading and interpreting statutes?
And on June 28th, 2024, the Supreme Court issued its opinion in Loper Bright Enterprises versus Raimondo, where the court overturned Chevron versus National Natural Resources Defense Council. Separately in your paper, I saw that you identified 8 states that explicitly endorse Chevron deference or a similar standard, 10 more states that partially endorse Chevron with inconsistent applications, and many other state courts echo Chevron principles without explicitly addressing delegation questions. So under this picture, who in state governments are ultimately making the law?
Yeah, I mean, so I think this, getting to Jonathan's earlier point, creates the urgency, we think, for this kind of discourse, especially in state governments, which is Chevron is no longer on the books federally, which means there's a set of states that are now in a very awkward position. I mean, for example, the Kentucky Supreme Court explicitly points to Chevron deference as that's how the administrative state, that's the relationship between the three branches in our state and Kentucky. So obviously that creates a set of challenges. But what I will say is, on the bright side, there are 13 states that before Loper were starting to lead the way by limiting deference, passing laws. In Florida, for example, there's a state constitutional amendment suggesting that judges must use stare decisis in cases of contested regulation. So in some ways, this movement that ultimately led to the overruling of Chevron federally started at the state level, and in some cases, even in the territories as well. So that's kind of the impetus for this piece, is let's get into state governments and see how we can fix some things before we get into an awkward kind of legal limbo. And also, from our perspective, on balance, reduce the kind of regulatory burdens that Jonathan was talking to earlier, strengthen separation of powers, give voters more of a voice over the coercion that gets in the way of their business activities and otherwise. So, I mean, but to answer the question directly, in these states where state courts are deferential to state level agencies, it really is more often than not the unelected bureaucrats, in many cases unaccountable, who are making the laws that have a burden on businesses and entrepreneurs.
And in the piece, there's a phrase, regulatory inertia. So what do you mean by that phrase? And you know, for folks who are listening to this, you know, how would regulatory inertia impact them, you know, whether positively, negatively, or, you know?
Yeah, I mean, so just like inertia you'd hear in a physics class, when you map out the total volume of regulations in the United States across various metrics, so language instances of restrictive language like ought, shall, required to, shall not, etc., or just total words, or total compliance costs, any kind of way that you slice it, the overall picture is, you know, a graph that's accelerating. It's like exponential growth, state level and federal level when it comes to regulations. That resembles, in our mind, a kind of inertia where the ball continues to gain momentum. And while you get kind of blips, whether it's Reagan or Trump, or in some states, the governor in Idaho, Montana, Iowa recently, Virginia, a kind of holding out hope for these deregulators in chief is insufficient to solve for the underlying root cause that has led to this regulatory onslaught. And really, overall, these are outliers, not the rule, and demonstrate that in the long term, we need some kind of structural change. We need to reconceptualize how we think about the relationship between the three branches and try to inject some accountability into the regulatory process, because you know, the fundamental point here, I think, in our mind, is that the total volume of regulations and the compliance burdens incurred by people who want to start a business, people who want to expand or scale their business across state lines, is only growing and at a breakneck pace.
And I think that's one of the reasons at Cicero that when we're working on policy reforms, we will write these papers like the one we're talking about today, but we take it the next step and we start putting together materials to try to help legislators take our ideas and implement them in their state. And so one of the ways we talk about in another paper we've written about dealing with regulatory inertia, of how do you deal with that problem, is encouraging states to impose a regulatory sunset. And we've got model legislation and we have talking points and other materials that will help legislators put those in place that explicitly require the legislature to see those, put those policies on the books, to force the agencies to then go through and put those regulations back on the books every 5, 10, 15 years, where they have to go back through the full process. If they need to put cost benefit analysis because their state requires it, they have to do it. If they need to do negotiated rulemaking, if they have to take public comments, all those things that are required under their state APA, requiring them to go back through that process using the most up-to-date data to determine whether or not those regulations ought to remain on the books is a really great way to deal with this regulatory inertia.
I mean, kind of the pithy follow-on to this concept of regulatory inertia is, how do you respond to regulatory inertia? You need a greater and opposite force. So rather than just focusing on a set of regulations that increase the cost of housing or make it hard to start your business, what we really advocate for in this policy, in that policy that Jonathan mentioned and others, is addressing the underlying structural forces that create the incentives such that this regulatory crisis has emerged.
And so related to that, you know, in the paper, there's a concrete proposal that you advance, which is a delegation dependent deference model. What's the goal of this model, and how does this treat differently state statutory delegations? You know, whether the state, as referenced earlier, the state clearly delegates authority to a state agency versus a state that has no delegation to an agency, but the agency acts by, you know, promulgating a regulation or perhaps issues guidance. And then there's a third category that you identify, which is ambiguous delegations, where like a state legislature might have some language that's not clearly defined or not as precise. So what does a state agency do with that? So could you explain like what the goal of your delegation dependent deference model is and how it would deal with these three different scenarios?
Yeah, that's a great question, Steve. So I think what we're focused on, again, because we're thinking about the states, you've got the majority of states with part-time legislatures, and you don't necessarily have their ability to have big staffs and the ability to pull the research together that they might be able to have here in Washington, D.C., where you've got Congress and they can call 500 hearings and take 6 months to deal with it. A lot of these state legislatures, for example, in Texas, they meet for one session every 2 years. And And so there's just a lot of work that they're trying to pack into a small session. And so saying to them, hey, you know, the solution is every single statute you write needs to explicitly define every single detail of every single thing. A lot of legislators would just look at Tanner and me and the other folks who are colleagues at Cicero and say, that's just not going to happen in our state. You know, maybe we should write better laws. And none of them would disagree with that. I've said it when I've testified before the U.S. Congress that they should write better laws too. But in states, because of this part-time legislature situation, and because there are circumstances where a lot of those legislators have experience in very different spaces that are not, they're not attorneys or they're not in the field that they're trying to write a statute about, there may be moments that they'll say, hey, we actually want our State Department of Natural Resources to determine how wide a gully needs to be so that it's still passable for the animal that we're trying to protect, but also allows water to flow in a way that's protective for the population in a flood situation. And so we wanted to create an opportunity for the courts to not always jump in and say, here's how we interpret if the legislature wants there to be something different. And so as you kind of laid out in your question, we proposed three different categories of items. And the first is when there's explicit delegation of authority. So if the agency gets authority in the statute, it's says, hey, Department of Natural Resources, we want you to determine the number of feet that this gully is. That's an explicit delegation. That's clearly a time where the court should not jump in and say, actually, we think the gully should be 12 feet and not 7 feet, even though the agency thinks it's 7 feet. That's a time where the executive branch has been given that authority by the legislature in those moments. Let the executive authority work. And so in those cases, really take all of the principles of Chevron deference that we've built up over the years and keep using them in those circumstances. The second is a situation where there's no delegation of authority at all. There's not any indication that the legislature intends for the regulators to do anything more than enforce the law. And so if it says 65 mile an hour speed limit, it's not for the agency to go out and say, well, 65 miles an hour can be measured in 17 different ways. It's no, you have to regulate and you are an enforcement agency, go out and enforce. And the courts shouldn't defer to an agency that decides to come up with guidance or a regulation that may divert from what the statutory language explicitly says. And then there's that third, and this is, you know, the messy middle that is always the hardest piece. And in the circumstances where the regulation probably needs to exist, right? Maybe we go back to that example about, say, unsafe toys for kids. The statute may say that at the state level. They may say, hey, state, you know, consumer protection agency, we want you to protect kids from this type of dangerous toy, right? It might be more specific. It might say protect small children from lead-based paint toys. Okay, well, now they know some things, but how much lead can be in the paint and those sorts of things? The agency and the regulated community, for that matter, may want to know that answer. And so they may all say, hey, we would really like some clarity on this. And so we think that in those circumstances, the agency should go ahead and start working on a regulation because they believe, based on conversations they've had with the regulated community, maybe with the legislature, with others, that there needs to be clarification via regulation here. They can draft that regulation, but rather than them having automatic authority for their regulation to go on the books without some sort of check, now they effectively present the regulation to the legislature, kind of like in a RAINS Act style setting. So a lot of your listeners would know about a federal RAINS Act. The bill's passed the House a few times. And the concept is large regulations, before they can go onto the books, have to get the approval of the legislature. We think the same thing could apply here, where if you have that situation where everybody goes, maybe there's some lack of clarity, we want to write a regulation. Now the agency writes that regulation, comes back to the legislature, and the legislature gives an up or down vote to the regulation. They're not giving an up or down vote to whether the agency has authority. They're not giving an up or down vote to whether they like the agency thinking about this regulation. They're simply saying, we think that this regulation you have written belongs on the books. In the same way that the legislature could codify regulations that are already on the books, and then they're no longer regulations, they're statutes, this would allow the legislature to have that extra bite at the apple to really decide whether or not when they wrote that statute, they intended for this outcome to be in effect.
And is this model, you know, is this model intended just for the so-called red states, which are, you know, Republican majority legislatures? Is this intended for just blue states, which are Democratic majority legislatures? Or, you know, who's your audience for this, I guess, you know, overall this paper?
I mean, I think any state policymaker that's interested in reducing regulatory burdens in their state, strengthening the power of the legislature, restoring judicial review in their state courts, state level regulations is one of these issues, I think, where the national prism of red versus blue doesn't work very well. We have a separate report where we ranked the APA's Administrative Procedures Acts in each of the states, and you might be surprised to see the way that it shakes out. Some blue states at the top, some red states like Texas, for example, Ohio, with tons of regulatory restrictions and some deeply broken, in my mind, Administrative Procedures Acts. And that's because these regulatory apparatuses go back, in some cases, over a century. So, of course, that would cut across many different governors and state houses controlled by different parties. So if you take, you know, this moment in time, it ends up not being too useful and can actually be confusing to superimpose the national red versus blue conversation. But really, I mean, I think this is a policy that any American could be interested in. The way we were thinking about this was trying to get as deep as possible on why do we have this three-branch structure in the United States at all, even looking back into some Enlightenment philosophy from the 18th century and just trying to figure out what is the proper role of the judiciary, what is the proper role of the legislature. And that's really the heart of an underlying thesis, I think, of this policy proposal.
Yeah. And in terms of, like, if you're a state citizen and you're, let's say you're driving around in your car or you're on public transit and you're listening to this podcast, what would you say to them in terms of, like, how a state legislature, whether it's, you know, a blue state, a red state, or a purple state for that matter, what would you say to them and how your delegation dependent deference model could serve their interests? So I basically, the question is, like, why should your everyday American in a state care about the proposal that you put forth?
Yeah. So to elaborate a little bit, and I'll get a little bit esoteric for a second, this three-branch structure we have in the United States, which has now been emulated by dozens of other nations, is really quite remarkable and is derived from a very deep philosophical tradition. In the mid-18th century, there's a French judge and philosopher, Montesquieu, who's writing in response to many of his philosophical predecessors. And this even can arguably go back to classical philosophy, but he isolates three levers of government coercion: legislative, writing the laws, executive, carrying out enforcing the laws, judicial, basically the backstop that when there are contests determining what the law actually says, whether the enforcement action was proper, etc. What he's really worried about, writing in the context of feudal Europe, is magistrates who in many cases oversee their equivalent of counties and control all three levers of government coercion. This unchecked power, in his mind, means that liberty is impossible. He has some line to that effect. When a magistrate has the judicial, executive, and legislative functions, there can be no liberty. So somebody like James Madison and many of the other framers of the Constitution were very well read in Montesquieu and others. Thomas Jefferson had translated many of Montesquieu's letters, for example. And when they were crafting the Constitution, they really had this in mind. So at a very deep level, how do we have a society that's conducive to the kind of entrepreneurship and innovation where the U.S. has led the world, of course, for a couple of centuries, and beyond that, have a culture that's welcoming to freedom and human flourishing and prosperity. They viewed this three-branch structure as critical to that end. So, but now to kind of, like, terminalize it to why should people actually care? I think in our view, it's not the job of unelected actors in the executive branch to interpret the law. And actually, it's even suboptimal for judges to interpret and ultimately declare what the law is. Ultimately, it ought to be the job of elected representatives as proxies for the public will to craft the laws that govern the nation. The elected representatives are the only people we have access to. The only kind of the most powerful incumbent firms have access to the regulators. So that creates a huge disadvantage for startups. But because in the status quo, lawmakers are not enforcing the laws nor adjudicating contested cases, there are inevitably these gaps and ambiguities that the other branches then struggle to interpret and resolve. So even if they make a good faith effort, the outcome still might be suboptimal because the regulators overstep or the courts defer. In other words, in the current system, once a bill is written and signed, the legislature has no official opportunity to clarify ambiguities, resolve uncertainties, or fill in these gaps. So that's exactly what this policy is trying to do, is put ultimately the people back in the driver's seat of the laws that govern them by giving the legislature an opportunity to clarify these ambiguities.
And so So under this, you know, proposal, I you know, there's a critique out there. It's typically manifested itself on the federal level. Sometimes it's made itself and it's shown itself to be in dissents of, you know, dissents to, you know, the major questions doctrine case or, you know, in Loper Bright that, you know, the expertise of agencies is now being stripped away. What do you have to say to that critique that for those who argue, hey, expertise is in the agencies, not in the state legislatures or in the state courts? You know, do you have a response to that?
So I think there's two things I'd say to that. First is I think our model allows for expertise if there's actually expertise in an agency. And so if the legislature truly believes that the State Department of Transportation is the best place to make decisions about how steep a curve or how high an embankment needs to be on the roads, then the legislature is completely within its rights under our model to delegate that authority completely over to that agency and say, hey, we, the legislature, are not the experts on this. We're going to pass it over to the people that we think are the experts. But I think the problem is that more often than not, that's not the process that has gone through in the past. What has happened is the legislature has passed a statute, and then a group of people who claim to have expertise in that are then simply taking upon themselves the mantle of, based on the expertise we claim to have, we are going to issue this regulation. And I think that's really where the breakdown comes. I tell people all the time, if I'm looking for the best chemist in the United States, we're not going to the Food and Drug Administration. We're not going to the EPA. There's some really smart chemists in both of those agencies. But the reality is the best one works probably in industry or in the academy. And similarly, if we're looking for the best fill in the blank of just about anything else, in fact, even right now, we've got all this emergency management going on. The best emergency management folks tend to work for someone like the American Red Cross or one of those sorts of organizations, not for FEMA. That's not to say that those people don't know how to do their jobs well. They do know how to do the job that they have been assigned pretty well. But that does not mean that they have special expertise in the topic that they now claim to be in charge of setting policy for the country. And I think that's the important question is, is their expertise simply in a scientific question of, is it safe or unsafe to consume this quantity of this chemical in water? That's a up or down, safe or not safe. But then the question is, at different marginal levels, the cost of imposing that sort of restriction, that's a policy discussion. And that's not the sort of thing that, even if they had expertise, which I'm, as I mentioned, I kind of question sometimes, but even if they had expertise, those balancings that need to happen, that's a policy discussion that really should be going to folks who have accountability to the citizenry. And the reality is, at both the state and federal level, the bureaucratic agencies have just gotten big enough that no one sitting at the top of them is going to be able to carefully evaluate every single one of those policy decisions that's being made by an expert, regardless of whether she or he is an expert in that topic.
Well, Jonathan Wolfson, Tanner Jones, thank you for being with us today on the Fourth Branch podcast. If listeners want to find out more about this paper, Restoring Legislative Authority, A Balanced Approach to Agency Deference, or the 2024 National Regulatory Reform Progress Rankings Report, or anything else that Cicero Institute is up to, where should they go?
Check out our website. It's ciceroinstitute.org. We've got a brand new website. Our comms team has been putting a ton of work in to get up and running, and it just launched. So would love people to take a look at it. And always feel free to reach out to Tanner or me or others on our team. We're happy to chat about regs, happy to chat about healthcare policy and workforce policy and homelessness and public safety and other issues that we're working on at Cicero every day. And if you're a member of a state legislature or work in state government, we would love to chat with you about ways that we can come alongside you and help you to get things done.
Well, thank you for being with us today.
Thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
On behalf of the Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch podcast. To catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.